Emily. And in any case, I am not privy to such information to begin with. It is unfortunate that you were attacked, but I am happy that you are alive now. The scent of fear was still there, mixed slightly with the peppery, hot scent of anger and indignation. The words sounded rehearsed, but that could have been my own paranoia. If Relyata was fucking my father, then she would have reason to want me dead. My father had many offspring, but I was his eldest and the single-born. I had rights to his land and title. Relyata would be wise to fear for her place, or any children she might conceive with him. A servant as capable as yourself must have an ear for gossip. No matter, though. When I determine who betrayed my father, I will rip their body apart with my fingernails. Anything you could do to expedite the discovery of this traitor would earn my gratitude and appreciation. I smiled warmly at her. Her scent filled the room with bitterness, and she met my eyes boldly. I will do my best to serve you in all aspects, mistress. I will continue my bath alone. Please prepare my dress and return when it is time for dinner. Yes, mistress. She fled to the other room, and I heard the sound of doors being opened and the gentle swish of silk garments being moved. I suspected it was one of my father's elders who had betrayed my travel information to the Yabadwa. But it would be useful for Rodiara to fear and respect me. I could earn true loyalty in time. I heard her leave the room, and I sighed in relief and leaned back into the water. If there was anything I loved as much as riding horses, it was taking hot baths. A pounding on the door reverberated in my ears and rippled the water of my bath. I had fallen asleep. The water was still hot, so I could not have been unconscious for long. My door opened, and I heard footsteps make their way toward the bathroom. The scent of the oils prevented me from identifying who had entered the room with certainty, though the rhythm and weight of the footsteps made me guess it was my father. "I'm in here," I yelled. He came in, glowering down at me.
"You should be dressed by now."
He crossed his arms over the chest of his green velvet robe. Rayara said she would return when it was time to prepare.
"What if she was late? You would disrespect our time."
He smelled angry, but there was a hint of something else. The bathwater was only somewhat opaque, and he could see my naked body from his standing position. He must have realized that I smelled his arousal, and he looked away toward the bedroom. That is such an interesting word. I found a wood comb on the ledge of the tub and ran it through my long, wet hair.
Time?
No, disrespect. I have found that those who use the word the most are often the least deserving of it.
What are you trying to say, girl?
He turned to me with obvious fury in his eyes and scent. I am not implying anything negative about you, father. Perhaps your elders have used that word often. You should keep a careful eye on them. I knew that his father was an elder, and had assumed the role of chieftain of the Laxiel tribe after an orchestrated uprising. They were supposed to help manage the various bloodlines and families of the tribe, but they would gladly betray the leader if it put them on a course of mastery.
I will consider your words. But for the next few months, I need you to be polite to them and ensure them that you are supporting my decisions and looking to create opportunities for our clan's advancement.
With my womb? I snorted.
This is the attitude your mother warned me about. She said you would be useless to me, just as you were useless to her.
Those are harsh words, and I'm sure she meant all the venom in them. I almost laughed. Cobras were less cunning and deadly than the woman. She would have tied me to a table, legs spread, and invited every male within 100 miles to inseminate me so that she could breed the next generation of strength for her clan. But I was stronger than her, and she knew this. The best way to combat a cobra was to cut off its head.
You are cunning. You got that from her. I will admit that my strengths lie in other places. This does not have to be an antagonistic relationship. Your offspring shall give us great leverage over the other clans, but I would also appreciate your perspective with the other elders and tribe leaders.
Hand me the towel. I gestured to them, and he got up to retrieve one. I stood up naked from the water and watched his hungry eyes appraise my body. His arousal musk poured into the room, and I fought back a smile. I will consider your words. I ran the towel down my breasts, stomach, hips, and then I parted my legs to dry between them. I am going to need instructors. Apparently we are good at hunting.
Yes.
The word escaped his mouth in a slow drone, and I could see the sweat pouring off of his brow, the sick fuck. Good. I will require some private instruction from the best in the tribe. Archery, riding, tracking, perhaps various weapons, the usual martial arts. I am sure your elders will identify them for me during dinner tonight, and then you can summon them. I will want to assess their abilities myself, of course.
Very well.
He choked out the words. Inbreeding had been against our race's laws since the time of the dead gods, but I had no doubt that if I bent over the bathtub, he would have fucked me right then. I found the idea repulsive, but his scent gave me all the information I needed about how to leverage our relationship to my advantage. Men were so easy to manipulate. Women had their desires as well, but our bodies and minds were not beholden to them. My father would allow me to delay mating, clinging to the fucked-up shred of hope that I would allow him to do the deed himself. I will change now. How soon until dinner? I dropped the towel in the bathroom and walked into my room naked so he could see my backside. The silver dress was laid out on the white bedsheets. The latest style in the desert tribes leaned toward a massive ribbons and wide petticoats. This gown was a sleeker design, simpler in its flow, with only minimal thin straps to hold it onto my body.
Quarter of an hour. Should I meet you there?
It was so clear he wanted to remain and watch me dress, but I had all the information I needed from him, and if he leered at me much longer, my own scent would betray my disgust and interfere with my ability to control the old man. Yes, I will meet you there. If you see Radiata in the hall, send her.
Very well.
He smelled like disappointment. Mulched rotting vegetables. A knock sounded at the door, and he moved down the foyer to answer it. As soon as it opened, the vanilla breeze blew into my bedroom.
She is getting dressed, he said to Radiata.
I will assist. I heard her footsteps enter, and his leave. By the time she made it to the other room, I was attempting to get my arms through the straps. Tell me of the elders. What would you like to know? I believe I met two earlier today, Zarmo and Dluzit. I forced myself to remember their names. There are three more, Vuma, Oiman, and Nyela. Reliara finished tying the back of the dress. It fit perfectly, perhaps a bit on the tight side, but that was how I liked my dresses. Then none would underestimate the amount of physical violence I was capable of inflicting upon those who displeased me. Which is the cleverest? Zarmo and Dluzit seem dumber than humans. I am not familiar enough with them to... Don't be coy. I'm sure you have an opinion. I turned to look in the mirror. My hair was still wet, but since I had combed it out, the red strands would not curl too much. Vuma is the smartest mistress. Also Nyela. They disagree on much, though. Each elder, save for Nyela, has descendants they will wish to breed with you. Yes, yes, yes. There was a waiting line for my loins. I will deal with that in time. Who has the most support with the people in the tribe? Your father, of course. She smiled and tilted her head. I didn't mistake her scent, though. This is unfortunate, Valdiata. I thought we were going to get along better. I shook my head and sighed slightly. I am prepared to serve your needs, Miss... I squeezed her throat with my left hand and silenced her. With a casual flip of my arm, shoulder, and hip, I tossed the woman against the mirrored wall. It shattered into hundreds of pieces, and she screamed in pain as the tiny shards scratched and cut her delicate skin. Let me make it clear for you, fool. I grabbed her blue-black hair at the skull and smashed the side of her face against what was remaining of the tattered mirror. When I ask you a question, you answer immediately, with all the knowledge in your little brain, and no attempt at cleverness to waste my time. Do you understand, pet? She blubbered something fearfully, and I pulled her face away from the glass shards. I am sorry, mistress. Please forgive me. Was what I thought she said. It looked like part of the woman's tongue had been cut off, and blood flew from her mouth quicker than the words did. Good. Now we are starting to understand each other. You no longer serve my father. You serve me. She moaned, and bloody tears streamed down her face. If you decide to try being more cunning than I am, I'll cut your body into pieces and feed the parts to the dogs. I'll start with your legs and arms so you can watch them feast upon you. Wake the fuck up! I shook her head and smashed it into the wall again as she looked like she was going to faint from the pain. Blood was all over my hands, arms, and the front of the beautiful silver dress. As I am sure you are aware, I do not make empty threats. Yes, Mistress, I will serve you faithfully. Excellent. I dropped her body back into the glass and stepped clear of the mess. When I come back, you and I will spend the night discussing everything you know about this tribe. I need to know who is loyal to you and where you get your information. We'll do it over some wine and dessert, so have it prepared. She nodded and forced herself to stand in the puddle of broken glass. Her face and clothes were covered in blood. I hoped that she would heal quickly. She had been quite beautiful, and I would have preferred her tongue intact. I almost felt remorse for what I had done to the woman. But fear without the occasional use of force was just simple anxiety. Where is the dining hall? It is on the grand floor under this room. West wing, I will take you. Now, clean this mess up, replace the mirror, prepare dessert, and wait for me to return. I can find it on my own. Yes, mistress. But, mistress, you are covered in my blood. I inhaled the scent of rosemary through the blood and her fear. Oh, well. I walked back through the foyer and out into the hallway. There was a small group of human slaves who bowed before me. They reeked of shit, piss, and other related sense of fear and inferiority that made me cover my nose briefly before I passed them. Fucking humans.
You are late, Ayala Rathi. What happened to your dress?
My father said when I entered the dining hall. There were 16 other finely dressed men and women sitting around the long table. They did a poor job of concealing their shock. I had to discipline one of your servants on my way here. The table was rectangular in shape, with 8 seats on each side and 1 at each head. My father occupied the seat farthest from the door, and a male elder, Vuma, I guessed, sat at the other head. You are in my seat, I said to the man.
Excuse me?
There were too many scents in the room mixing with the food for me to pick out his, but his facial expression was as expected. You are sitting in my chair. Move, I commanded.
No, girl, this is my seat.
He scoffed and glared at me. Do you see the blood on my dress? Any additional red will only improve it at this point.
Are you threatening me?
He forced a laugh and then turned to my father.
This brat needs some manners beaten into her.
I pulled on the world and then flung out air. I wanted to roast him alive, but the suddenness of his body flying from the seat and smacking into the stone wall of the hall, 30 feet from the table, was satisfying in its own way. There was a screech of swords being drawn from the various armed individuals in the room, but I only counted 4 weapons. The fact that they didn't attack me immediately made me think that they would never have the audacity to do it. As I was saying, I picked up the plush leather chair and sat it right side up at the table. I slid into it and crossed my legs under the dress. This is my seat. The broken man against the wall moaned in pain but did not move, nor did anyone else in the room. Father? His face was as white as the sheets on my bed, and his mouth hung open. It looked like he was turning back into rock. Why don't you introduce me to your elders and their descendants? Start with the one who thought this seat was more important than his life. I gestured to Vuma and smiled at my audience.
Chapter 7 The Obarni. The islands floated across endless heavens. From my perch on the edge of the cliff, I could see a vast sea of blue sky, white clouds, and tiny pinpricks of emerald green islands dotting the horizon like dark stars. I held my breath and turned the island around again. In the center of the island was a small cluster of tropical trees, grass spread over the ground like splattered paint, and not much else. I squeezed my eyes closed and tried to remember how I got here. I could not even remember my name. Suddenly I knew I was Kyair, and with that recollection, everything else followed. I remembered every other important event in my life, up until I was captured by my former friends. Shlara was alive. "Maybe you are dead?" a man said behind me. It was a voice I would have recognized anywhere and any time. I turned around to face the old man, and he appeared as I always remembered. Short, skinny, with long, wispy white hair and a goofy monkey grin on his face. "Entus?" His name left my mouth in a whisper of surprise. "Hello, Kyair." He smiled wide and took a few steps toward me. He held his thin bamboo cane in his right hand, and his shuffle was as I remembered. "You are dead," the words came out of my mouth before I had a chance to consider them. "Oh, sure, but you are missing the obvious question." He made his usual chuckle. "Am I dead?" My stomach dropped. "Are you?" He smiled and squinted at me. He was close enough now to touch, but I didn't dare. "I don't feel dead." I realized how stupid the words sounded as soon as they left my mouth. How would I know how it felt to be dead? "If you are dead, don't you think you would remember how you died?" He bobbed his head like an owl. Perhaps this was a dream. But when I dreamed, I normally woke up when I realized it was a dream. "I don't remember dying. I remembered being dragged back to my cell after the horrifying meeting with Shlara. I remembered pacing the dank cell for hours." "Ah, then you must not be dead. Although, you do have a bit of a problem with your memory." "I do? Of course. I've spent thousands of lifetimes trying to figure out why. Best guess I have is that it is some sort of coping mechanism. It has made my job quite difficult." He snickered again. "Entus, I have no idea what you are talking about. I never understood your riddles. Is this a dream?" He opened his eyes, and for a moment anger flashed across his face. I had never seen the expression. My second father had always been in a humorous mood. "I suppose you could call this a dream. This is where they are made. But everything is made here. Life, death. It is an intersection of sorts. You could look upon it all," he winked at me and grinned. "If you had the right perch, that is." "How did I get here?" "Same way you get anywhere. You decide that you want to go, and then you act upon those desires. I have a better question for you. Why did you decide to come here? Why do you always turn this around on me? Just give me a straight answer." He didn't look angry anymore, but I was. "Ah, my friend," he shook his head. His long white hair danced around his shoulders. "I have tried that. Thousands of times. It only led to destruction. This time I explained nothing, and still you've come so far. I have decided that next time I won't even introduce myself. I'll just watch from a distance. Now I know I'm not dead. You just gave me a headache." I rubbed my eyes at the bridge of my nose and tried to make sense of his words. "Recall what I said about this place. Really think about it. Then tell me why you are here." "I don't know," I screamed at him. My head was pounding. "You didn't even think about it. You just replied. Damn it, think. I can't do everything for you." He sat down cross-legged on the dirt in front of me and set his cane over his legs. "Start by putting what I said into your own words. You said this is where dreams, life, and death are created. You said it is a crossroads, and you could see everything from the right position." The words came out slowly, and my head continued to throb. "Good. So if I believe that, and you believe that, then why are you here? Fuck, my head hurts. I was used to pain, but this felt like my brain was twice the size of my skull and beating on the insides. Another defense your body has. Answer the question. I just wanted to lie down and die. I couldn't think of a way to escape my cell. I couldn't save Iola Rothy. I couldn't fix Schlara or repair the relationships I had damaged with my generals. I wanted to change. What did you want to change? He raised an eyebrow. The past. I've made so many mistakes. Ah! He jumped up suddenly and did a little dance with his bamboo cane. This is wonderful. You almost did it. Almost did what? I didn't know if it was his silly dance or the glee on his face that was driving my headache, but I almost felt normal. Figured out why you are here, so close. I will try not to get too excited, but I've been waiting much too long to reach this point with you. Keep talking. My brain must tie the concept of change with you. That is why I am dreaming of you right now. He sighed, and I realized that was not the answer he wanted. You can't change the past, especially if you are dead. I thought you said I wasn't dead. I said no such thing. I asked if you remembered dying. Do you? No, but that doesn't mean anything. Nothing means anything until you give it meaning. He chuckled maniacally and leaned back on the dirt. Fuck, Entis. So I am dead? The headache had returned full force. If you were dead, but woke up not dead, what would you think that meant? He smiled slightly and hooted like an owl. Death is permanent. Everyone dies. Perhaps you aren't everyone. But we aren't making any more progress. You should wake up and think about it some more. I'll be here when you need me. His words echoed in my head 100 times, 1,000 more, and then I woke up on the cold stone floor of my cell. Chapter 8. Kyre. But it was not the cold stone floor of my cell. I woke up in a tree, 200 feet off the forest floor. My first few seconds of consciousness left me scrambling madly for something physical to touch or smell to ground myself in this time. If I had not secured myself to the branch before falling asleep, I would have spun off the limb in confusion and made a Kyre puddle on the distant dirt beneath my perch. Did I dream of Entis? Or did I remember a time I had dreamed of him? The question, along with the cryptic ones he had posed in the dream, occupied my mind for the few minutes it took to untie myself from the tree. I determined that there were no elven scouts nearby before scrambling spider-like down the trunk of the massive evergreen. It was midsummer, and the forest that separated Naya's southern border from Brilla hugged the edge of the canyon like a green blanket. I knew I was a few days' journey from Nadia's keep, but I was unsure of my exact location. I doubted there would be elven scouts in these unexplored woods, but since the Empress had not recovered my body, she would be searching for me. Prior to ascending the tree the night before, I had heard the sound of a small creek 100 yards to my east. I walked toward it now, and eventually passed through the thick forest canopy and into a glade the water had carved. The flow was not strong, but it was quick enough to keep the stream fresh. The creek and a bed of lime-colored moss, flanked by blackberry bushes, convinced me to break my fast here before continuing my journey. I opened the cloth traveling satchel that Jancy provided and pulled out the last of the smoked fish, hard cheese, and carrots. I did not feel hungry, but I had only eaten a tiny amount in the last 2 weeks of travel, and I was close enough to the keep to justify consuming the rest of my provisions. The bag also contained some herbs, salt, pepper, and a flagon of water that I promptly drained and refilled in the creek. Then I set about eating the small meal while I considered Entis. The old man had always been a mystery. Aside from a few sklads who somehow traveled nomadically and undetected by the elvens, all of the humans of my time were enslaved, except Entis. Not only had he spent his long life living freely, he possessed the power of the elements and a mastery of them that could have only come from decades of patient practice. I had asked him about his life, what he had done prior to saving Thayer and me from our elven pursuers, but he had evaded my questions and turned them around to ask me for details about my own life. I still wondered who changed him, who taught him, how he had managed to live freely in the mountains. He was indirect in his instruction, posing riddles or using cryptic, unfamiliar phrases to teach me of our magic, war strategy, and leadership tactics for our army. There were plenty of times he frustrated me immensely, but when I carefully thought through his words, I always found the answer and realized how brilliant his seemingly crazy technique really was. Maybe that would happen with the questions he posed in this dream. As I considered his words and their deeper meaning, it soon became apparent that I would not find the answers now. I was too distracted by my current situation and the traveling yet ahead of me. The answers would come, as they always did, when my mind was clear and unburdened by other obligations. I finished my meal and gathered a few handfuls of berries for dessert. They were more tart than sweet, but the juice refreshed my palate and further prodded memories of Jesme to the surface of my consciousness. She would have appreciated this picnic and would have delighted even more in the process of picking and eating the fruit. My heart ached at the memory of her, and I wondered again what had transpired the night I had infiltrated the castle to rescue her and Nadia. I recalled going to Nadia's room with Danor, Runir, and Beltor. I knew that I had intended to tell Nadia about her mother, but then my memory faltered and broke pace with the familiar headache. It was the same pain I felt in the dream with Entis. Why did I have these pains? My healing abilities should have prevented them. Any physical discomfort was only temporary until my magic fixed the injury. Yet there were giant holes in my memory that caused immense pain when I tried to recall them. Was my mind trying to protect me? Were the memories so horrible that something deep within my consciousness was punishing me for wanting to relive them? When Nadia and Pog had first awoken me, I remembered little more than my name. Now my memories were nearly complete, as far as I knew. I recalled an entire lifetime of struggle against the elvens, the camaraderie I had developed with my generals, the internal war with my feelings for Iolorothi and Shlara. I remembered saving and then betraying my people on the same battlefield. I remembered the aftermath of those choices. Surely there could be nothing more devastating to protect me from than what I had already remembered. Perhaps I just needed more time, and the missing parts of my past would be made clear. I filled up my water bottle again from the creek, and then splashed some on my face. The memory of twisting through the underground river beneath Naya flashed through my mind, and I remembered that there were more secrets beneath the castle than the river. the ruins of the strange buildings, and a radical were entombed beneath the great fortress. If the elvens had chased me into the catacombs, they could have taken possession of the temple as well as the ovule I left there. Maybe I escaped under the dungeons without their notice. Perhaps they had followed me down there, and the hives of deadly worms had destroyed them. I stood from the brook and continued my journey eastward, first on deer trails and then on roads that were only wide enough for two people to walk abreast. I was tempted to run, but instead just jogged. The terrain was rocky and steep in some points, and while there was some cover from various oak and cedar trees, I wanted to keep my senses sharp for possible elvens. Even my jogging speed was faster than a horse trot, and I could do it all day without tiring. I saw little evidence of human presence on these trails. Even after I had traveled until the sun was past its peak, I did not see or smell anyone else in the countless valleys, ridges, and canyons I crossed. The feeling almost reminded me of the years I had spent alone tracking Iolorothi through the wilderness of my native world. Back then I was avoiding my own people. Now I would have appreciated a break for conversation and companionship, no matter how brief. I feared no one on this planet. There is nothing more dangerous than me within a few thousand miles. The jagged points of the teeth were a constant companion. They were visible from the towers of Naya's castle, but I had not realized how huge they were. Even after weeks of travel, they had only grown marginally larger, yet they dominated the skyline. I made it to the top of the next tall valley and let out a slow whistle of appreciation. The east side of the country lay before me. It spread like an endless green bowl of glass, cracked by fine blue rivers and tiny blemishes of stone. The sun hung about three quarters through the sky and shone from the perfect spot in the west to highlight the endless miles of unspoiled land. To my right, I saw the foothills of the teeth, emerald mounds of soft grass punctuated with what looked like grains of sand from this distance, but they were actually massive boulders. The mountains rose sharply, an impossibly steep wall cutting through the foothills like abrupt monoliths that emerged from the depths of a green ocean. Though I stood 30 or 40 miles away, I still had to crane my neck to look up at their sharp peaks. "Where is the keep?" I said aloud, partially to hear a voice, and partially because the answer wasn't clear, even after studying the mountain range for several minutes. The solitude was creeping into my brain, bones, and muscles. I spotted a break in the grasslands that flowed horizontally across the basin. It was either a river or a road, and I decided that heading down into the valley would be the only way to find out. The grade was steep, but I was skilled at sliding down such embankments, and soon sprinted down the slope and into the valley. I had not seen any elvens, humans, or herd animals from my perch atop the ridge, but the grass was tall enough to conceal many things in its depths. I found the road I had seen from above. It was wide enough to easily hold four wagons abreast. Deep gravel covered the surface, and while I saw plenty of tracks laid in it, I couldn't guess in which direction it was flowing or how long the tracks had been there. I understood that Nadia's keep was positioned on the rocky slopes of the teeth. I imagined that there would probably be a settlement in or around the fortress, so the road must flow toward it. I jogged eastward on the gravel path in the direction of the foothills and hoped that I would be able to make it to the keep before nightfall. From down here it was evident that there were many farms, ranches, and other settlements branching from this main road. There were plenty of grazing cattle, but no humans attended the herds. I took that as a bad sign. I reached the first foothill and sprinted up and over it, crossing a few more miles of hills until the path forked north and south. The northern route was wider and looked more traveled, so I took that direction. After another mile, I crested the final hill and saw a village situated at the base of the mountains. From the village, a road led up through the mountains to Nadia's keep. Naya's capital city spread out from the massive castle like a spider's web. I had expected this eastern fortress to have a similar design, but the keep looked more like an upturned hand emerging from the rocky cliffs, its tower fingers running parallel to the sharp, rocky edges of the teeth, opened as if to catch the moon. The fortress was enormous, built of the same dark gray basalt as the mountains. With my enhanced vision, I saw that the main road twisted sharply to the east after the last building in the town. The road was barred by a massive stone barricade. The path cut deeply into the stone, and I noticed small pinprick holes dotting the canyon walls above and to the east of the barricade to allow archers to defend the fortress. An army might take position in hidden corridors cut into the mountain and prevent any attacking horde from relative safety. The wind began to pick up, a dry, throaty howl that galloped through the giant emerald canyon, jumped the foothills, and caught in the pass of the mountains. The sound was a deep, lonely pitch, and echoed off the teeth and bounced westward another mile. The city below me was deserted. 50 large horned oxen meandered through the streets absently, munching from flower beds and fenced gardens. Chickens perched on thatched roofs and fluttered and pecked around the feet of the larger animals, scratching and searching for bugs. There were no humans. The streets and buildings were silent and still. The homes were in good repair, but not recently used. There were no lingering scents of life, no cooking fires or garbage, not even the sign or smell of a chamber pot or wash water lately emptied in the street. I wanted to believe Nadia's army was safely entrenched up in the keep. They could not defend this city from an elven invasion, so they could have chosen to hole up in the fortress. It was certainly large enough to accommodate the remains of Naya's army. I hoped it was true as I made my way through the empty streets and began the steep ascent to the castle, but I knew it was unlikely. An army of that size would need food, and the chickens and cattle would have been rounded up for slaughter, or at least tended carefully for their milk and eggs. They would have set a sentry to report movement in the city. Clearly, no one was here now, but had my friends come and gone, or never made it? The wind picked up as I traveled higher, resonating like a song. I wondered if the seasons changed the angle and speed of the winds and gave the canyon a new tune to howl with each passing month. I thought of Nadia as a child. The haunting melody of the wind must have been comforting and familiar to her, the sound of home. The condition of the road improved dramatically as I reached the end of the city and moved up toward the slopes. These stones were evenly cut, but still abrasive enough to grant herd animals and wagon wheels purchase on the incline. For a second, I wished that the road was still loose gravel, so I might have checked for signs of someone passing. At the top of the switchbacks squatted the gate of the fortress. It was composed of 3 20-foot-high barriers, constructed of iron as thick as my torso. Each portcullis was operated by massive pole chains that stretched almost 100 feet up to the gatehouse. The mechanism for raising and lowering each gate was bigger than an ox cart and probably required 4 people to man. All 3 of the gates were closed. This gave me a brief sense of hope. I still did not see any sentries, but perhaps the army went inside the keep and then closed the doors behind them. Someone had to have been here to shut the gates. I looked around for a way to bypass the barriers and decided that my best avenue would be through the gatehouse. I quickly scurried up the first massive iron cage door, jumped up to the chain that controlled its movement, and passed hand over hand underneath its length until I entered the gatehouse. The room was smaller than I expected, but the gears were as I imagined, giant nests of cogs, wheels, spokes, levers, and springs, with functions that I didn't even bother to puzzle out. I thought of Pog, and knew that if my young friend were here, he would have been excited to study the device and discover exactly how it worked. He and Malik were very similar in that fashion, and the comparison made me consider the other attributes they shared. I risked a slow sigh of regret and sadness for the words I had not been able to speak to either of them. There were arrow slits on both sides of the stone gatehouse, and I looked toward the inner courtyard. I didn't see any movement or hear any noise besides the wind, so I opened the heavy door and descended a staircase to the courtyard. The sun was setting quickly. What little red light made its way past the towers and mountains was stretched so thin that it did little to illuminate the entirety of the castle. My vision was good, even in darkness, and I took a few moments to analyze the layout of the fortress, its towers, walls, and various structures. I had little experience with defensible fortresses. The wars I fought were in the open wilderness, or attacks on their roughly defended estates. None of the elven homes or structures were close to the size and greatness of the stone fortresses of Naya. The most impressive elven estate would have been an average-sized house in Naya or Brilla. Either humans had naturally advanced in their understanding of architecture and engineering in the thousands of years I had slept, or the humans of this planet had always possessed greater skill than the elvens on my homeworld. I had spent enough time in Castle Naya to guess where the main living areas should be. I crept toward the nearest one, but kept my senses alert for any noise other than the wind. The path curved like a snake through various untended gardens, rock sculptures, and training grounds, across stairs and over ledges. From every angle there were beautiful views of the green valley below, or the sheer dramatic walls of the teeth. As the sun continued its death, the rocky slopes were awash with a golden sparkle. I looked upon the splendor through Nadia's eyes as I thought of the way she had described her love for her home. Finally, I made it to the largest of the stone structures and opened the iron-wrapped pine door. I had guessed correctly. This was the main hall of the keep. Unfortunately, I had also guessed correctly about the inhabitants of the outpost. There was no one there, not even rats or other pests that tended to overtake such places when the humans left. It was still and cool inside. The air had not been stirred in some time. I walked through the keep's innards for a quarter of an hour to be sure I had missed no traces of recent occupation. It was empty now, but it had been looted. Where tapestries and paintings had hung, the walls were bare, with the faintest outline of soot-stained stone, indicating the shape and scope of the former decor. Chandeliers lay smashed on the floor, their skeletons picked clean of any valuable crystal or scrap metal. There were no candelabras or urns, no weapons or shields, no crests or banners. The kitchen was free of all traces of food or sense of cooking, which explained the lack of vermin. I came upon what had clearly been an impressive library, and my heart broke for my friend as I saw what had been done. The shelves were emptied. What books remained were piled on the floor, torn, water-damaged, in disarray. By the time I circled back to the main doorway, the light from the glass windows above had turned a dark purple. I sat at the foot of the tower's staircase and pondered my next steps. Nadia's army never made it to the keep. There were no signs of struggle here, no blood or bodies. The hordes had arrived unimpeded, taken what they wanted, and left with their bounty. The plan had been ridiculous. How could we have expected them to escape the elvens? The Empress's army was large and powerful, and they were nothing but a few weak humans. I ground my teeth together in frustration. My hubris had overcome my judgment again. I may have been a great general, but I was only one man now, one man alone, here against tens of thousands of powerful elvens, elvens with magic and skill that rivaled their O'Barney contemporaries. I could change Nadia's soldiers, but it would take years for them to learn enough to be a formidable force against the elvens. And none of this could even begin until I found Nadia, Jesme, and whatever else was left of Naya's royal family and army. Perhaps I should have worked with Nadia and Jesme to negotiate a truce. That would have bought us some time to prepare. Maybe the relationship between Nadia and the Empress could have developed into something peaceful. Talaxthi was shocked that I knew of her daughter, but quickly regained her normal, cool composure. "You are assuming I care about such a creature," she had said. "It is your own child. I doubt your species would have survived for all these generations if you cared nothing for your own offspring. All creatures do. It is inborn and instinctive. Your perceptions of our race continue to bewilder me, Kyair." She reached for the glass of wine she had sipped before Kanneth's arrival had interrupted our dinner. She gulped the rest of the glass down before continuing. "We breed for power and status to make the next generation stronger. Did you know that humans and elvens could have offspring?" "I suspected such." "Oh?" Her eyebrow rose slightly. "Was this from your research into the Destroyer's history?" "So there is a way for our races to create children?" I ignored her question. "Under certain conditions, an O'Barney and elven may procreate." "What conditions?" I thought of Io Larothi and the daughter I had never met. "You are running out of time for our private audience. Are you sure you want to spend it discussing this process? Perhaps you wish to make a child with me." She smiled and leaned her head to the side. Her dark bronze hair fell in that direction and exposed the spot where her neck met her white embroidered robe. I recalled the way her scent had worked its strange magic on my emotions and caused me to lust for her. The feeling returned, and I exhaled. "Your daughter is alive. I am guessing you didn't believe her to be. If you really don't care about her location, then I suppose we have little more to speak of. Kanneth will take me away, and you'll get this world all to yourself." I stood up to leave, but she grabbed my left forearm. "Sit." She tugged slightly, and I returned to my position next to her. My arms were still covered with Yilomar's blood, and she wiped her hand on a napkin once she released her grip. "What do you want?" "Prevent Kanneth from taking me." "That is a dangerous proposition. Once the clans find out that you are here, and that I interfered with Kanneth's mission, they will descend upon this world with an angry fervor. They will capture you anyway, and in the process, my kind might be destroyed entirely for having aided you, not to mention the humans you hold such affection for. So the answer is no. What if I told you the location of the radical I came from? That mitigates some of our risk. She licked her lips and then smiled. But I imagine my daughter is on this world somewhere. It might take me several years to find her, but I will. I have an army at my disposal. What if she isn't on this world? You intend to destroy the radicals. I am offering her location and the location of two radicals. Two? Her emotions did not show plainly, but I guessed I touched on information that she wanted. But I am not done with my requests. Prevent Kanneth from taking me back. I will return with Jesme. You will surrender your forces to her, and we will negotiate some new territory for your people to inhabit. You overestimate her importance to me again. She shook her head and sighed. She is nothing but a tool for me, a weapon with powerful potential. But you have already guessed at my intent for the radicals. Once they have been destroyed, I do not need her. Very well. It seems we cannot come to terms. I tried to hold my face firm and control my heart rate. The Empress was better at this than I. I imagined that she spent countless hours negotiating with her own people as well as the O'Barney clan leaders. All I had was that brief second when I surprised her with knowledge of her daughter, that small flicker of emotion in her eyes, and the assumption that parents must love their children, or at least want the chance to love them, and have the sentiment returned. I stood up again and walked toward the exit of the tent. My back was to the Empress, but I doubted she would strike me down with so much at stake. Kyair, her voice finally sounded behind me when I was halfway up the stairs. I turned and saw her amber eyes flash. We stared at each other for a few seconds before she spoke again. Kanneth and his warriors have to die. It will buy us more time before the clans find out. I nodded at her words and pondered the morality of colluding with the Empress of the Elven people to kill my own kind so that I could save a world of humans. "You will tell me of my daughter immediately upon your return," she continued, "after your army has surrendered to Jesme. You think disarming and surrendering will stop my conquest? We have magic. We hardly need swords. You are just one man. Earlier you said you never go back on your promises, but then you said you might have to make an adjustment to that statement to kill Nadia. Are you saying you will betray our agreement as soon as I tell you of your daughter?" "No," she clenched her jaw. "But this puts me in a predicament. I've promised my own people freedom. This is now our world, and I intend to lead my people to safety. So you are deciding between your people and your daughter. That is unfortunate." I forced myself not to smile. One wrong word, and I could destroy the progress made so far. "I will surrender. Then you tell me of my daughter and the radicals. You will keep your word and negotiate with Jesme on our behalf for our own territory." "Agreed," I sighed and felt hundreds of pounds of pressure lift from my shoulders. "My sister will shadow you to where Kanneth's men are holding the princess. Indicate when you want to attack, and she will make her move." The winds howl echoed through the courtyard of the keep and startled me into the present. The sun had set, and I was now sitting in absolute darkness at the foot of the staircase. If Talaxthi had captured Nadia, she would have discovered that she was her daughter. That leverage might be gone, but there was something else I could use. It would depend upon whether the Empress cared for her daughter or simply wished to use Nadia as a weapon. The rest of my quest could wait until morning. I would have to forge my way west, directly toward Naya's capital, to see if there was any trace of Nadia's army. I could leave now, in the stillness of this dark night, but the idea of descending from the mountain keep and then crossing the endless valley did not appeal to me at the moment. There were enough pieces of broken furniture and leftover bedding for me to make a comfortable camp for the night. I had nothing to eat, but fasting was easy for one night, and there was plenty of food awaiting me in the village at the base of the mountain. "Kyair," a voice called out to me, echoing across the hallways and up through the vastness of the tower that spiraled above me. The hair on the back of my neck stood, and I shot to my feet. Silence fell, and I tried to determine if the voice was real or imagined. Then I heard it call my name again. The voice was carried on the wind from the courtyard outside of the keep. It was a woman's timbre, familiar but unclear. I moved to the door of the tower and opened it cautiously before stepping out into the starlit night. I saw no one on the ledge of the wall and detected no movement outside. I listened for heartbeats or breathing, but the wind was masking any subtle noise and preventing me from using my sense of smell. The voice rang out a third time, calling my name from deeper in the courtyard. I headed toward it, regretting my lack of a weapon. My eyes were drawn to a glowing object on a bench in the middle of the garden. It was not there when I first came through the courtyard, but there was no mistaking the ovule now. It pulsed yellow, its network of spiderwebs glowing with an alien energy beneath the etched surface of the globe. There was no movement in the courtyard. I approached the glowing sphere, picked it up, and marveled as the glow grew brighter. The web network seemed to move in response to my touch. "That is yours," the woman's voice said from behind me. I turned around and braced for an attack, but none came. Instead, she stepped out of the shadow of the small tower and walked through the courtyard. "How did you find me?" "Your companions told us of your plan," Veer-Nine said. She adjusted the dark gray cloak she wore and then crossed her arms. "So you captured them?" "Of course. They almost made it to the keep. We spent many days looking for you in the castle, but you had disappeared. Once we caught up with Naya's army and interrogated them, we knew that we would eventually find you here." "You have been waiting for me?" "Yes." Her lack of emotion wasn't surprising to me now, though I did recall the passion she so unabashedly displayed when I had fucked her and Islata for hours. "What do you intend now?" I set down the sphere so that my hands were free. "You've lost, Kyair. My Empress has asked me to come here to present you with her parting gift. Take the ovule, go to the Radical in the Teeth Mountains, and leave this world. You belong with your own kin and deserve the fate they have in store for you." In the strange yellow light from the ovule, Veer-Nine's pale, ashen skin and placid face made her look like a corpse. "Where is this Radical?" I didn't really care about the answer, but it was the easiest question I could come up with while my brain scrambled for a plan. "We don't know yet. I'm sure you will find it after a few weeks of searching. Take the ovule." "Did you come alone?" "No." She gestured behind me, and I turned my head slightly. On the distant wall, I perceived the movement of a few dozen shapes. They were about 200 yards away from me, so I doubted they would be able to hit me with arrows if I ran. "I am surprised that you didn't bring Islata." "You are trying to make me angry," she seethed the words. "The Empress has been very generous, and you choose to mock Islata's death." "Islata is dead?" The news struck me in the stomach like one of Thayer's kicks. I did not believe I had any feelings for the woman, but the clench of my gut told me otherwise. Viernine opened her mouth to reply, but no words came. She tilted her head slightly and examined me for a few seconds. "By your hand," she finally said. I don't remember. My voice caught in my throat as a tidal wave of images crashed into my head and drove me dizzy. I remembered the halls of the castle, my friends leaving through a hidden passage in the wall. Islata stopped me in the hallway and demanded my surrender.